Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, our weekly opportunity to take a look at the world of theater and the arts. And today we open the show with a brand new book by a guy named Mark Melkoff, who is joining me now, who wrote a book about one of everybody's favorite TV hosts, Johnny Carson. The book is called Love Johnny Carson. Got to have a subtitle, One Obsessive Fan's Journey to Find the Genius Behind the Legend. Mark, congratulations on the book. It's fabulous.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much. I still can't believe I talked to over 400 people. It was unbelievable. It was this 12-year journey, and it took one curve after another, and I just followed it.
And by the way, people can go to your carsonpodcast.com. See, after I read the book and I knew about the podcast, I started listening to Rich Little and Stephen Wright, all these people, they're still around, but people on there who are no longer with us. So it's just been such a fascinating journey. It's going to take me forever to get through it, but congratulations on the interviews, the podcast. People can check out your work. And people were willing to talk to you. Johnny, most people saw him as a pretty private guy, but people talked to you.
For whatever reason, his friends and the people that loved him that worked for him for the first time, a lot of them, they said that they trusted me for some reason. I really had no agenda other than I really liked his work. But everyone from Mel Brooks, who was on Johnny's very first show, to his producer, Peter LaSalle, I would just go to California. And back then, you couldn't record remotely for podcasts. So I'd be in people's living rooms. I'd be in their offices. It was unbelievable. But it seemed like because it was Johnny Carson that everybody that normally might say no or be hard to get, they would all say yes to me because they loved Johnny Carson, which is why the book is called Love Johnny Carson.
Yeah, it's not just your love for Johnny Carson. It's everybody's love for Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
And you know, your start with Carson, I think like most of us of a certain generation, it's because our parents, there was nothing else you'd ever watch at night besides The Tonight Show.
When I was a kid in Arlington Heights, my dad would let me stay up Fridays and sometimes during the summer. And there was just something so likable about Johnny Carson. And they would do these primetime clip anniversary shows every October. And we'd record it on the VHS and I'd watch it over and over again. And Johnny would be so funny with the animals. He'd be with kids. He'd be with famous movie stars. But then he'd be with people that weren't even famous, like the potato chip lady from Indiana, who was a potato chip inspector, and she noticed that they were in the potato chips were in the shape of objects, and Johnny made her worldwide famous. I mean, she was going all over the country, all over the world.
But Johnny had that famous power because of something he did to her on camera.
That was Johnny's idea. Johnny had the brilliant ideas while she was showing her potato chip collection, which were in the shape of objects and people. Johnny had Ed McMahon distract her, and then he bit down on a potato chip, and this woman, Myrtle Young, thought that Johnny had eaten her collection, and she almost, it looked like she was going to have a heart attack, and then Johnny revealed, no, it was a separate bowl off camera of potato chips, and it made the anniversary episode every year. There were certain clips that the public demanded. One was that clip with the potato chip lady. Another was
Ed Ames,
and before I knew it, I didn't even know Ed Ames was still around, and suddenly I'm in Beverly Hills with Ed Ames. He's in his 90s, and he's telling me, Mark, I did not know how to throw a tomahawk. Mark, I told my wife after it happened that night, the funniest thing happened, but it will never air because of the NBC censors. But Carson in his brilliance told NBC at that point, it's going on TV, and it did.
And by the way, people of a certain age know what you're talking about, but younger people tend to watch us on the podcast side. So what happened that night? Ed Ames comes on. There was a reason he did the tomahawk thing, right?
It was in the mid-60s. So he was on this huge television show, Daniel Boone. Mm-hmm. And in the opening, he would throw a tomahawk, but it was trick photography. And of course, it would hit the tree. So it's like him and Johnny were going to take turns throwing tomahawks. And they were going to throw it into a wooden cutout of a cowboy. And Ed Ames goes first. And he did not know how to throw a tomahawk. They had a rehearsal for him right before the show. And he took one throw. And this was destined to be because it hits the crotch area of this cutout. And back then, this was really risque. And Johnny, in his brilliance, Ed Ames goes to retrieve it while the audience is howling, and Johnny holds his arm. And Johnny lets that play out, that laugh, for like a full minute before he goes into Jack Benny mode and does these ad-libs. To this day, it is still considered by TV historians the longest sustained laugh in the history of television. And every October when they would have their anniversary show, they'd play the clip. There were a few times Carson thought, you know what? This is overexposed. We're not going to play it. And they would get mountains of mail from people that just demanded it every year.
He knew how to play an audience, work to an audience. I think that was part of his, and you say this a lot in the book, that Midwestern charm. He was from Nebraska. He wasn't an Yes. LA kid to begin with. So he just understood what it meant to relate to people. And he wanted his guests to shine. The spotlight was never about himself.
That was his rule. His number one rule, like some other host want to try to get the laugh for themselves. Johnny's rule, which was unique, everyone told me, was to make, I want to make my guests look good. Like the monologue Johnny knew was all him, and they do a comedy piece that was all him. Maybe he'll do a sketch, but then it was all, I'm going to make my guests look as good as possible. He never made fun of his guests. Like Merv Griffin made who was a popular host, made the mistake of trying to make fun of Tiny Tim, who was a singer with a high falsetto voice. Johnny never made fun of him, and famously, 45 minutes million people turned into the Tonight Show, which was a huge record that stands today for a late night show, when Tiny Tim got married, only second to the moon landing. And that was the power of Johnny Carson. And he was just such a likable guy that people would tune in all over the country. It didn't matter if you were from middle America or from the cities. Everyone, Carson was appointment television viewing.
By the way, Tiny Tim, who used to sing I'm Laughing, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, yes. He was so effective with Carson that Carson had another special evening with Tiny Tim.
Yes.
You're talking about the wedding.
Yes, the wedding was unbelievable. So Tiny Tim went on the show a few times, and then Carson in his brilliance said, why don't you get married here? And Tiny Tim would never turn down going in front of a national TV audience. He had just met this woman. He went to a book signing in Philadelphia, and 10,000 people showed up to Tiny Tim's book signing. I mean, the Beatles were fans of his. Bob Dylan was a fan. So, he met this 17-year-old woman, and he very quickly proposed to her. Her parents said, why not, even though he was much older. And then they got married on The Tonight Show. 45 million people tuned into TV history, and that was in December of 1969. And people still talk about that, but that was Johnny Carson's brilliance.
To the wonderful Miss Vicky.
Yes, she's still around.
Yeah, he's not, but she is. Yes. And he called her Miss Vicky. You know, there were things that Carson started, some of which carry through to today, some which don't. By the way, one of the things I picked up from your book, which was Carson had like four writers today. The stars of nighttime have their 20 writer staffs, and Carson worked with four. Sometimes people made fun of him like for not working a lot, because he got eventually down to three nights a week and all that. But the bottom line was he was working all the time. And after a while, he was just getting older, and it was an energy thing, right?
Yeah, that's right. He told David Letterman, I don't have that energy anymore. He started with an hour and 45-minute show five nights a week. And then NBC on the weekends had him going to the affiliates and doing all these dinners and luncheons. He was exhausted. Then the show went down to 90 minutes. Finally, in the early 80s, like 1980, Carson said, I've had enough. We're going down to 60 minutes. He got ownership of the company of his TV show, because he was 25% of NBC's profits. I mean, it was unbelievable what Carson did for the network, and he had so much leverage. And yeah, Johnny was the network, the face of NBC, Bob Hope and Johnny Carson. And Johnny never wanted to be Bob Hope. He thought Hope stuck around way too long, which is one of the reasons why Carson, when he was 66 years old in 1992, got out when he did. He was impeccable with his timing. That's what all his friends consistently said. They said he knew how to enter and when to exit. And they all told me the same thing, which was that he was almost the same person you would see on and off The Tonight Show, which was a huge revelation for me. But the friends all told me he had to feel comfortable with you. And it was a small circle of people. But they told me you could not fake 30 years on top and go in front of the public and not be yourself.
And, well, you also said that when he retired, there's sort of a misnomer that he like faded from the scene, and you went, he did not fade from the scene.
He was not J.D. Salinger or Greta Garbo, as the media made him out to be. He retires on May 22nd, 1992, and for two solid years, he does the Bob Hope 90th birthday, the American Teacher Awards, The Simpsons, Kennedy Center Honors. He's given the Presidential Medal of Freedom from George Herbert Walker Bush. And then in May of 94, he makes a cameo on Letterman, which is such an emotional thing. He comes on as a surprise with a top 10 list, and the audience gives him a minute standing ovation. And Johnny sits at Dave's desk, impromptu, Letterman's desk, and was going to say something, but he couldn't even get out the words because the applause was so thunderous. Johnny finally gave up, walked off, and that was the last we did see of him. But he was out with doing lunches with his old writers. He was with friends. He was on his boat. He was going to Africa with people like Jim Fowler, who was a guest on the show with the animals. So he was out and about, but he did like his alone time here and there. But he was definitely more social than people thought.
there are so many stories. I want to talk to you about them. But yes, one of the things you do, you open the book. It kind of surprised me, basically by asking everybody, who was Johnny Carson really? And I think that's your way of saying, because we have an image of him, but you knew him. What was he really? And so let me ask you, obviously, yes, people could read the book to find out what people said. Mm-hmm. But I have two questions to ask you. Number one, your version, after all these interviews, who was Johnny Carson?
And Carson was a man who loved comedy and loved to shine and loved his vocation so much. I mean, he'd been performing since he was 14 years old. The Tonight Show was his life. He had friends. Unfortunately, being number one for 30 years and being so competitive, something was going to suffer. So his family life and his four wives and kids, they did suffer. But in terms of somebody that was in front of the American public for 30 years, that remained number one, I don't think there was anybody better at this than Johnny Carson. In terms of Jerry Lewis calling Carson Chaplin, I mean, he could do anything. He could talk to anybody. He could make people look good. He made himself look good. And people still to this day, Johnny's been off the air now for 30 years, which is shocking to most people when you think about that he's been gone that long. Every poll, still, he is number one, voted number one late night host of all time. And all the late night hosts still talk about Carson. That's the reverence that people still have to this day. There's no one that is going to outdo Johnny Carson.
I'm guessing you've been asked that before. Now, let me ask you this question.
Yes.
If you had interviewed Johnny Carson and you asked him, who are you? What's his answer?
I think he really didn't understand why so many people were obsessed with him in terms of his career and his personal life. I think he would just say, I'm somebody from Norfolk, Nebraska, who just loved to perform, who loved comedy. At the end of the day, I think he would say he was just Nebraska, and he was just a guy that loved comedy, that loved to laugh, and that was just endlessly curious. I think that's what it was. He wasn't hanging out with the A-list movie stars after the show. He'd have dinner with people like Carl Sagan and Jim Fowler. Yeah. That was his life. I mean, but he loved comedy. Like Jack Benny, when Jack Benny died at that funeral, he went home and for three solid hours was bawling his eyes out. Those are the people. Buddy Rich, the most famous drummer probably of all time. When Buddy died, Johnny found out right before the show, and people told me on staff that he was crying his eyes out. You can tell that night. I've watched the tape many times, and Johnny's eyes are all red because he had been crying previously. So he had this reverence for show business. He loved show business. And I think that at the end of the day, he was happiest. His friends told me, he admitted he was happiest by far when he was doing The Tonight Show. And I think that that is not surprising.
What is interesting and consistent in the answer that I just forced you to create is the fact that, well, here's what you didn't say. And I became the greatest talk show of all host of all time and whatever. In other words, what you left out of your answer was the ego that perhaps he just didn't have.
He wouldn't say that. I mean, he definitely was very competitive. And at one point in 1971, had four TVs going on in his apartment at 11:30. He was watching his own show, his competition, Dick Cavett. He was watching David Frost's show. And he was watching either Merv Griffin or Joey Bishop. So he had the competition. But he did not put himself in the same league probably as Jack Benny. And he was always in awe when somebody like Richard Pryor or David Letterman was on, so much so that the material itself, Johnny would be worried about the material and make it extra edgy and extra good just because he knew that they'd be watching the show. And you wouldn't think a guy like Johnny Carson would be insecure like that, but he just wanted to be the best he possibly could. But at the end of the day, he did not consider himself anything special. He did consider himself in a situation where he could do a lot of good things and to use his gifts to help people. He didn't want the credit. There are some famous people, every time they give money, they want a press release. Johnny did, and I go to, in the book, it's covered in length, the amount of amazing things he did behind the scenes. So that, I think, is Johnny's legacy. I mean, when he died, it took a couple of years for it to be revealed that he left $180 million to his foundation, which still pays out millions every year to foundations, to charities all across the country.
He made a difference.
Yeah.
I have to ask you about some of the stars. The book is so filled with that. But first, there was something that, I mean, he's known for this, but other people didn't nobody, to my memory, has picked up on this, but it was the magic, as you know, of when Johnny, when a comedian was on, especially when a comedian was on, whether you got called over to the couch, whether you got a thumbs up, whether you got an okay sign, there were a variety of things, and it could make or break a comedian's life. And you share with us in the book, am I right that the first person that got involved with this was Peter Barbuti, who's still around?
He is still around in Las Vegas, and he was the one person, the first person to my knowledge that was called over. And for whatever reason, I think Johnny just was having some trouble that night, was in a bad mood, that Barbuti got called over, and then something happened, and then he was not allowed on the show with Johnny for 14 years, but they made up, and then he went on the show another 30 times with Johnny. But to my knowledge, only 15 people in the history of The Tonight Show were called over. I will say that Rodney Dangerfield was one person Johnny said, I'm never going to call this person over. Over in 1969 when Dangerfield debuted, because they had feuded a little bit, but Johnny was relented, but he's like, I'm not going to call him over. But Dangerfield was so brilliant that Johnny said, I have to, and called him over and was won over, as was America. But to be called over was huge, and then to get the okay sign was another thing. But so, some people like Jerry Seinfeld took 5 times going on before he was ever called over. So sometimes you'd get called over automatically, like Ellen DeGeneres. Other times, it would take a while to get called over, but everybody was obsessed with Johnny's approval.
By definition, these stories have to be short, but like you mentioned Rodney Dangerfield. I was fascinated by that because there is another side in the book to that story, and that was Rodney Dangerfield's own ego, that even when Johnny was relenting, Rodney was sort of like, I ain't going on. So there are two sides to that story.
There really are. And then Rodney in the early 80s supposedly helped Johnny home. When Johnny would talk on The Tonight Show about his struggle with drinking. He would say he would have one more drink than he should, and he would turn into Attila the Hun. He wouldn't remember things. And Dangerfield apparently helped him home once after a comedy club. And Dangerfield never got a thank you, so he refused to go on Johnny's show for something like 8 or 9 years. And it wasn't until the end of the show where Dangerfield got a little nostalgic that they were able to convince him to go back on the show with Carson. But like Johnny, like Rodney, they both were very much like in their head, whether if it was real or not, if they were convinced that they were in the right, it was almost a close. It was almost like nothing black. Everything was black and white. Nothing was gray. Like Joan Rivers to Johnny just didn't exist anymore. And Dangerfield was like that as well. Once they were hurt, the relationship was pretty much over.
But again, more than one side to these stories, because even with regard to Joan Rivers, if you listen to Joan, and by the way, among my collections, I own her makeup kit. Anyway, it's in a nice gold bag. It's interesting. Yeah. But anyway, Joan, of course, would tell the story like as though it was Johnny's fault somehow, whatever. But that's just not the story. And
it's
I know you talked to Melissa Rivers. I mean, you've gotten a lot of more detail on this.
I would have loved to talk to Melissa Rivers. I wasn't able to, unfortunately. I know people that know her, but I was able to talk to Barry Diller, and I was able to talk to Johnny's producer, Peter LaSalle. And Barry Diller told me that he told Miss Rivers, you have to tell Johnny. Joan's own friend said, Johnny's going to be furious. You need to tell him. She famously did not tell him. Johnny found out that Miss Rivers was going to be competing opposite against him, and Johnny had made her, for 3 years, the exclusive guest host of the Tonight Show. Johnny was devastated that Miss Rivers wouldn't tell him. And one of the wives said Johnny started crying and was just devastated. And then Miss Rivers proceeded to try to take Johnny's prize producer, longtime producer, Peter LaSalle, which Joan admits, Peter told me the whole story. And then every talent coordinator that Johnny had, Miss Rivers offered to double their salary. And Johnny just could not believe that Joan Rivers, who he had made her career, that she would try to take his staff. And he just famously never forgave her.
And she went to Fox. I mean, so Fox was trying to compete, and you know, and
yes.
There's not dissimilar stories in the Jay Leno part. There's so much to talk about, but I talk about one of my favorites, which is Barbara Streisand. Because there's it's a brief story about Barbara Streisand, but you know, you talk about the first time she was on. Now the truth is, Barbara Streisand was first on with Jack Parr. That's pre-book, so I guess it doesn't count. But I think her fame and stardom starts on the Jack Parr show, where she sang the Sleeping Bee, this quirky little weird song, but people went nuts. But then she comes on to Carson, and at some point Carson looks at her and says, man, you're going to be so big you won't want to come on here. And she goes, I'm never coming back.
It's really true. She was on Johnny Carson's fourth show, and she was so determined. Even back then, people were in awe of her talent. And it was one of those things where in the last few years it's come to light. I knew this privately, but I talked about it in the book just because Ms. Streisand admitted it. She never went back on Johnny Carson's show, first and foremost, because she would have had to switch places with Johnny. She will only be filmed from one angle, and she would have to sit at Johnny's desk. They would have had to switch the desk and the chair, which Rosie O'Donnell did to get her on her show. And some people like Jimmy Fallon would do it without acknowledging it. But Johnny, if he would have known, would accommodated Miss Streisand. But she famously canceled in 1975, just like a day or two before. And it had been advertised with the network, and Miss Streisand just had cold feet because of that. But Johnny didn't know the reason why, but he would have made accommodations. But Streisand stayed off The Tonight Show for 50 years until Jimmy Fallon agreed to switch places with her, which they did. And that was the holdup, apparently.
And I remember that show because I of course watched it, and I wondered what he would do and how they would handle it. And I'm sure you saw it and remember it. But as she came out, he said, "It's so unbelievable that you're here. Take my seat. Take my desk at the dare." And she said, "Really?" You know. But that's exactly what had to happen.
Yeah, Jimmy Kimmel thought it was too strange that they would have to switch places and just didn't said no. I mean, he had the opportunity to have Miss Streisand on and thought that was such too unusual and didn't know how he would justify it. But you know, it is one of those things. That Johnny did try to get Barbara Streisand near the end of the show and almost got Marlon Brando, because Johnny and Marlon Brando are both Nebraskans and were friends. They would talk on the phone and almost got Brando back, but wasn't able to. It might have been because Brando had packed on some pounds and was self-conscious. But Streisand, 50 years famously off The Tonight Show before going on with Fallon. But Johnny would have loved to have her on.
Well, you wrote about Brando. Isn't the first story sort of Brando... Brando just kind of wanted to do it, just to have the experience of doing it, and wasn't he sort of drunk when he went on?
1964, Johnny had this idea. It was the first time that they ever went to Los Angeles to do the show. The show was based in New York, and Johnny had the idea, we're going to be such a good show that we're going to have champagne for all our guests. It's going to be flowing backstage. Now, currently, if somebody like Tom Cruise or somebody famous is on a late night show, they're the first guest. Back then, they would hold the most famous person to the end to make sure the audience stayed for the whole, back then, 90-minute show. So they had Marlon Brando for 90 minutes chugging champagne until he was ready to go on. And Brando was drunk out of his mind and got into a verbal fight with Zsa Zsa Gabor, who then walked off. And Brando, a couple years later, went on Johnny's show in 1968 and admitted he was wasted, and they talked about it and kind of laughed. But yeah, to get somebody like Brando was a huge deal. Like Joan Crawford was on Johnny's very first show, and to get somebody, a movie star, on The Tonight Show was a big deal back then.
But and there were some people, and you talk about this, people who never did appear. Katharine Hepburn, you know,
that's right,
who never appeared the show. Were you able to earn any insight about, I mean, you know, she was a private person, but I don't know, why wouldn't somebody like Hepburn go on to promote a movie?
I think she was really self-conscious, and someone like Cary Grant, just TV was considered not prestigious. So Johnny would see somebody like a Cary Grant or a James Cagney at parties and, you know, politely maybe request that they come on. But for whatever reason, it was like, if you were on television, you didn't do movies. And if you were movies, you didn't do TV. Like somebody, for example, like Kirk Douglas would be at The Tonight Show and ask the talent coordinator, "Can you introduce me to Don Adams of Get Smart?" Because they would never cross paths. The TV people didn't know the film people and vice versa. Now it's all blended in. So, but yeah, Johnny always tried to get those three people, and he could never get Benny Hill on the show. There were certain people that he tried to get on the show that for whatever reason, maybe they just to be themselves was very, very hard. That's one theory for some of these people, that they, if they have a script, they're brilliant. But if they're on that show as themselves, they could crumble.
One of the things that kind of gave me, I guess, a little disappointment in him is your story about, and because I assume every story can be symbolic of other situations we may or may not know about. But Johnny was like an amateur astrologist. He loved astronomy, you know, I shouldn't say astrology, astronomist. Anyway, he loved astronomy. And Carl Sagan was one of his favorite people. But you write in the book, until Carl corrected him, then bye-bye, Carl.
That's right. It was twice on the air that Johnny was corrected twice by Carl Sagan and interrupted him twice. And Johnny, like David Letterman as well, just very sensitive. You would think somebody, especially like Letterman, who would sometimes make fun of the guest, would have more of a thick skin. But Johnny and Dave, both of them, Johnny was still friendly with Sagan. They kept in touch, but he would never have him back on the show. It was one of those things where Johnny would have somebody in, he would consider having somebody into his home. And if they didn't have the manners that Johnny thought that they should have, they were gone. Like Jerry Lewis was rude to the cue card person, and Johnny told the cue card person, Jerry Lewis is never going to be on the show again. I mean, Johnny, he expected everyone to have impeccable manners, and Johnny prided himself in having impeccable manners. If people came up to him for an autograph or a photo, he would do it no matter what. I mean, he would always stop. But if he did have a drink in him, that is when you wanted to leave him alone. Ed McMahon famously was the one that got him in the cabs in New York and took care of him and babysat him. But by Carson's own admission, he would say he would want to fight everyone. And he knew that that was a struggle that he had for a lot of years.
I'd always wanted to meet Carson. I never did, but I spent some summers teaching out at Pepperdine. Carson lived not far from there. There was a restaurant that he used to go to all the time, forgetting the name of it. But I would go there on frequent times and go to the restaurant. They knew who I was, and I talked about Carson, and they said, yes, that's Johnny's table. So we'll sit you here, and we don't know if Johnny's going to come in, but if he does, that's where he's sitting.
There are a couple places. Granada was one. Monroe's was another one, but he took tennis lessons from John McEnroe at the Pepperdine, the university got tennis lessons because he sold his home to John McEnroe and put in the contract that McEnroe has to give me tennis lessons. And neither of them had a tennis court. But that's amazing. That's very cool that you almost, I mean, if Carson would have walked in, you would have gotten to sit next to him.
And then I would have stolen his fork or plate or something because, you know, I got to add it to the collection.
Yes.
There's also the music part. You mentioned Buddy Rich before. And indeed, if you were to ask me, what do I think Carson's favorite kind of music is? I would lean towards the jazz and that kind
That's
of,
right.
you know, that sort of era. That being said, you make a point of saying, actually, Carson pretty much loved every kind of music, though not a huge fan of rock.
He wasn't, but he would still put on some iconic people. Like one of the funniest clips is ZZ Top coming on, and then it cuts to Johnny with the long ZZ Top beard. That was a one-off. Like once in a while, he would put on an Alice Cooper, and it would almost be shocking to the country. But for the most part, he loved Tony Bennett. He loved people like Joe Williams. But with the guest host, that's when a lot of times you would get a Jimi Hendrix in New York or people like that, more of the hard rock people. But Johnny, the only thing that Johnny discriminated against were people that did not have talent. If you had talent and you were a musician, he would put you on the show. I mean, the one thing that he did hold back, which he did admit, was that if somebody was too overly energetic, like Billy Preston had people on his feet and people gave him a standing ovation, and Johnny never would have him on again with him because he was considered the fifth Beatle, because Preston was just, people were going to sleep, Johnny thought. People are going to sleep with the show. They don't want to be overly stimulated. So Preston was not allowed back. That was like, you would never think that would be a problem with Johnny. But the over-the-top energy sometimes he didn't think was good for the show.
And it wasn't just about movie stars. Now, I'll be honest. I think most of the stuff in my mind on this person came from your podcast, from listening to this interview. So I hope that's okay.
Sure.
But that's Frank Abagnale Jr. Jr., who is the focus of the movie Catch Me If You Can with Leonardo DiCaprio. But
that's right.
It was just recently here in Chicago. It's a musical that was on Broadway. I met Frank, was there the night that I saw the show and got to meet him. In fact, I said to him, because I'm a lawyer and I teach the bar review course, and I said, Frank, how did you pull off the practicing law in New Orleans thing? And he explained, he says, because at that time you didn't have to you didn't have to go to law school. All you do was pass the bar. So he actually took the course that I teach. I didn't know it. And before I was teaching, but he took that to get entry into the bar. But all of that by way of saying that one of the things I learned from your interview with him was the fact that if Carson was interested in you, you didn't have to be a movie star, TV star, but if you wanted to be on, you're going to kind of have to foot the bill for making it happen along the way.
It was definitely a curiosity thing. Johnny had been watching the Today Show and saw Abagnale that was interviewed. And I think Abagnale had to maybe fly himself out on his own dime to get interviewed by one of the talent coordinators. And then Johnny put him on. And the next day at the hotel, he gets a phone call and he said, Johnny Carson for you. And Johnny said, you need to write a book and about your life and your adventures. And Frank Abagnale said, I'm so young. And Johnny said, no, you have to do it now. I'm going to give you a literary agent. She's about to get out of the business, but she's the best. And she's the one that got him a publishing deal and everything that happened with the movie that ended up eventually years later happening. So yeah, Johnny Carson had that power. Unfortunately, there have been some charges that Mr. Abagnale nail some of the things that he has claimed might not be true. I'm not sure. But right. in terms of somebody being launched and that movie with Spielberg and the musical and everything, it all came from Johnny Carson and The Power of the Tonight Show. You can't argue with that.
And he even telling you, Carson, that Abagnale said that Carson told him to join the AFTRA union, which I'm a member of, because yes. he goes, then I can pay you.
That's right.
Dale to do this.
Residuals, yes.
But the reason I bring this up is yes. really because this is a conversation about Johnny Carson. But in that yeah. interview, and I know you did it about 11 years ago, I'm putting you on the spot sure. with some of this stuff. But Abagnale tells you that when he had his first appearance on the show, he comes out with his wife. His wife is in the green room with the Lennon sisters. And do you remember that part of the story? Now, the Lennon sisters at that yeah. time, I'm sure some of our viewers have no idea who we're talking sure. about, but they were a big deal. They were sisters, and you know, and they would perform. Today it would be equivalent of the sisters in Hamilton, the Schuyler sisters. But anyway, but at that time, he is in there. He goes on the show. Do you remember in that interview what happened with regard to the Lennon sisters when Abagnale was on set because he went on first?
I don't think I do. I talked to so many people in hundreds of hours, so please fill me in.
So what he did was, Carson yeah. said, I want to keep you on, kept him on an extra segment, yes. sent that message back to the Lennon sisters, and ultimately, yeah. he tells his producer, tell the Lennon sisters they're cut. I want to keep talking to this guy.
Yes.
That's stunning. They were that big. He was nobody. I mean, Abagnale was nobody. What a story.
It was curiosity. I remember actress Jennifer Tilly told me that she was a bump for the potato chip lady. If Johnny was curious about somebody or if they were getting laughs, they were going to stay on. So it was one of those things where I talked to some people that were on the show, and they knew that if something was working very well, they might get bumped. But you could be a famous music guest, you could be a famous movie person, and still get bumped for somebody that was not famous if Johnny felt that the audience was enjoying it and if Johnny was intrigued, which is very, very much Johnny. That would never happen today. Today, it's all about social media accounts and the biggest movie star. Back then, Johnny's prerequisite is they had to be a good talker. They would put people on that, like Buck Henry or Phyllis Newman, that were just really good conversationalists. They didn't have to be A-list movie stars. But now, everything is very different. And if you're not a big star, you're not going to get one of those bookings. But back then, it was all about the conversation.
And I could talk to you for hours. That's not fair. Yeah. You need to read the book. But just a couple more little things.
Let's do this. This is fun. I'm having a great time.
One, the category of the game. I mean, today you have people like, well, Leno, who I would not Leno anymore, but people that would play games with the audience. I mean, it didn't start with Carson, because his notion of Stump the Band or Karnak, the yeah. amazing Karnak, where he would guess what the question was, he would say the answer. But he got it. You write about this. He got into a little bit of a squabble with Steve Allen, who goes, that's my bit. And Steve Allen yeah. preceded Carson.
It was tough because Johnny and I did the research. He had bought the rights to this game, which became Karnak, which was in Collier's Magazine. This gentleman named Carl Winston invented the game, I think, in the 40s. And in 1948, Johnny bought it for like $200 and was doing it locally in Los Angeles, the kind of like the Karnak routine. And Steve Allen then got The Tonight Show, and he started doing a version nationally that his writers came up with. This does happen sometimes that comedy writers think of the same bit. But Carson, even though he had the rights to it, knew that the public, if he did this on The Tonight Show, that he would get accused of stealing. So he waited until 1964, Johnny, 2 years into The Tonight Show before he started doing Karnak. He felt that the public had accepted him and he could get away with this. But yes, yeah, Steve Allen, up until I think probably he passed away, would accuse Carson of ripping this off, even though this other gentleman, Carl Winston, would say Steve Allen ripped me off and wrote a book and did all these things and didn't give him credit. So yeah, there was definitely a little back and forth. Steve Allen was banned from doing the show with Carson in the early 80s for allegedly being rude to one of Johnny's staff members. And I think Steve Allen did not like that as well.
And just a quick question about guest hosts, because you yeah. talked about Joan yeah. Rivers becoming the permanent one, but
yes.
he used to have a million of them because he eventually went from five nights to four to three, and people yeah. got their chance. And Michael Landon, I mean, you talk about yes. people, like, what are they?
It's unbelievable.
Right. What was it about? Just let's give everybody a chance. Or was it about Carson saying, I'm going to pick people that won't, upstage me? I don't think that was it.
I think that Carson just got a kick out of all these people that were so confident as performers, thinking they could get up and do the show. And sometimes they were really good, like a McLean Stevenson or a Joan Rivers or Richard Dawson. But so many people, like an Arnold Palmer, I mean, that's surreal, or Diana Ross getting up, and Joe Namath, people you would not think about, Kirk Douglas, Lorne Greene hosting The Tonight Show. There were people like Charles Nelson Reilly who would get so many laughs on with Johnny, but could not guest host himself. So it was one of those things where I think Carson did kind of get a kick out of that, because he would watch the show. But somebody like Chevy Chase, who was one of the biggest movie stars in 1986, he tried to guest host the show and couldn't do it very well, according to Chase. Then he went on with Carson and said, "You have the hardest job. I had no idea how difficult it was. No one's going to be the next Johnny Carson." And then Chase famously, just a few years later, takes over and gets his own late night show, and I guess forgot about how hard it was and lasted 26 episodes. But Johnny made it look easy. He made it look effortless, and it wasn't.
One last guest host story. Soon we'll be honoring again the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. So that triggers, of course, the week-long hosting by Harry Belafonte. And something happened there that within the scope of time and when things happened really created kind of a quagmire for Carson that he handled brilliantly, as you write it.
Yeah, Johnny was very much against the Vietnam War and had very strong views, and he liked to put people on like Gore Vidal and other people that had shared the same views. Johnny wouldn't publicly talk about that, but he put people on that would have his views. And he called Harry Belafonte up in 1968 and said, "I want you to, would you please take over my show for a week?" And Mr. Belafonte couldn't believe this. February of 68, Johnny said, "Have on whoever you want." He's like, "You've got to be kidding me." So Mr. Belafonte got people like Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and NBC was terrified. They called Mr. Belafonte up and they said, "You really going to have Martin Luther King on? Like, you're not going to talk about race, are you?" And he said, "No, we're going to talk about opera. Yes, we're going to talk about race." So it was revolutionary for a late night show, first of all, to have a black guest host for a whole week, which was wonderful, which Carson had done previously, Pearl Bailey and people that were wonderful, like Flip Wilson. But for Harry Belafonte to have a whole week like that and put these very social people with very social programs and advocates on with very strong controversial views was revolutionary. It really was.
Yeah. And then, do you remember the moment there was an issue about running that interview? Because then King, of course, was assassinated only a couple of months later.
It was horrible. Johnny Carson walked off the show after hosting the show, and that at this time it was 90 minutes. It was about 9 o'clock at night, and he was told that Martin Luther King, tragically, had just been shot and murdered, and had just been pronounced dead. Johnny didn't occur to him that the network would ever run his show that night, because they had already taped the show and they had made no mention of Dr. King. They had no idea. They're just laughing. It's lighthearted. And NBC had preempted for news coverage. But then when it hit 11:30, they put on Johnny's show that they had just taped with the debut of Tiny Tim. And you see Johnny and everyone laughing. And there were people to this day that still think the Tonight Show is live. And they thought it was live. And Johnny the next day had to do damage control because they got so many complaints, phone calls and letters. Johnny had to say, "No, this was pre-taped. And tonight we're going to do a tribute to Martin Luther King Jr." And Sammy Davis Jr. asked if he could come on, and he said a lot. And then Diana Ross and I think the Supremes, they came on and they sang. And it was this tribute to Martin Luther King. And they showed the Mr. Belafonte's interview with Dr. King from just like a month or two prior. And it was historic television. And thank goodness it exists, because most of the Tonight Show, the first 10 years, do not exist. The Ed Ames clip only exists because Carson, in his brilliance, after that taping, said, I need this for my collection. I can't believe this actually just happened. I just want this. And that's the only reason that exists.
When you think about it, and I know even today, like when 9/11 happened, one of the things I wanted to do was see how the late night comics were going to handle it. And of course, they were off the air for quite a while. And as you know, David Letterman was the first back.
He was eloquent.
Yeah. And just had to start with this magnificent sort of monologue. No comedy, no anything. But he basically had something he needed to say. And that's the way it is now. Something tragic or terrible happens, we turn to them. I want to wrap with a happier kind of a concept, because that's how we should do this.
Okay.
If Johnny were around today, would he be offered a late night slot? I mean, would he get a show today? Or was his environment in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, into the 90s, didn't even get to Bette Midler, would he be like, "No, my days are over"?
I don't know how he would fare. His definitely would have to pick up the pace. Like, he would have interviews sometimes, and they wouldn't have to have a laugh every 10 seconds. The audience would sometimes wouldn't laugh at jokes. Now they laugh at the monologue jokes. They either laugh or clap. Like, Johnny was brilliant because he could recover when jokes would bomb, but they don't bomb anymore. I think just audiences are different. Carson was a different kind of performer. I don't know how he would do, but I do know one thing. I don't think people would know his politics. He made fun of everybody equally with presidents, but he did think that the show had to be about entertainment and have about making fun of people. And that Carson said, people don't want to know my political opinions and I'm not qualified to give them. So I don't know if that would work out with today, but I will say that if people go on YouTube, you can see on the official Johnny Carson YouTube channel, they have over 1 million subscribers. People miss him. I mean, people are still talking about him decades later. The work holds up. And that says so much about that man.
Yeah, you even had a story in there, but I'm sorry, everything you say triggers things. But when he went to LBJ's inaugural, and he performed there, and he said something that was a political comment. He didn't mean it that way. It wasn't taken that way. LBJ and Hubert Humphrey went up to him, loved him, whatever. But then a journalist decided to go after him, and he had to deal with it. My point is, what a complex world he lived in, and we all still live in. But back when he lived through it, the dynamics were different in terms of today. You would say something, you say, the heck with it, that's my view. But Johnny was very conscious and careful to say, I have to appeal to the entire country.
Yeah, he did that well. Occasionally, if there was something he really believed in, like there was, he thought that there was somebody that was sentenced to 12 years in prison for marijuana with a small amount, and he took to the airwaves to really say that this is unfair. There were certain things with social justice, like Anita Bryant was a singer who had some really strong views on gay people, anti-gay laws, and Carson just went after her in the monologue, and people like Tom Shales and some of the gay groups said that Carson just annihilated her. I mean, when he thought something was unfair, he would just go up against the person. But overall, it was rare when he did that. Overall, he realized he was an entertainer. I'm Bob Hope. I'm Jack Benny. But if something was very, very extreme and he felt strongly, there were times where he would go to bat for people.
My last question, your subtitle of the book is Your Journey Was to Find the Genius Behind the Legend. What's the genius?
I think the genius is that this guy was able to have, as somebody that I talked to that worked on the show, have this Rolodex in his mind of all the ad-libs, of all the jokes that he has ever heard, and was able to pull them out at any time. He was able to interview somebody and then be able to, at the same time, think about what he was going to ask next and go to that Rolodex. He's the only person that has ever hosted the Oscars, and he hosted like 4 or 5 times. No cue cards, no teleprompter. He was able to just edit in his head, and I don't know if any other late-night host can do that, but he was constantly doing that. And just the likability thing. I just think that in his DNA, there was just something likable about him, and I don't think anyone will ever touch him.
Mark Melkoff, Love Johnny Carson is maybe the definitive biography of Johnny, because it not only is it fascinating and interesting, but I mean, you do it. It's not just he was born here blah, 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 and walk through the biography. Yeah. You give us the stories. You did the interviews, man. You did the homework. I want to recommend that everybody pick up a copy of Love Johnny Carson, but also take the time, as I've been doing, to go to thecarsonpodcast.com, because those are many of your sources. Those are the people you talk to. And you did that. Yeah, I found interviews from 2014 and whatever. I mean, this has been, 10, 12 years of your life going on?
It has. We're putting on some new conversations as well, because in the last 4 years since I've been working on the book, I didn't realize that there were all these other people that had Johnny stories and people that went on the show. And if there's stories to tell, I really want to get them out there. And it's been exciting to hear from people. And as you mentioned, so many people like Bob Uecker and all these, even people that were younger, like Bob Saget. There's just so many of these conversations. And it took me a long time to really accept the fact that people were thanking me. These icons would thank me for doing this. And I really feel like that they're saying thank you to Johnny. But just the fact that they would give me their time and this was important to them says so much about Carson.
Well, I'll be happy to do an interview to explain how I got this mug in my hand that once sat on Johnny's desk and why it's now in my hand. How did that happen? That's a fascinating story to tell. Mark Melkoff, congratulations on the book. What's
Thank
coming
you,
up
sir.
Next? Is there another project, another late night related book coming out?
Oh, I'm right now. I have a podcast called Inside Late Night for Late Nighter, and I'm just interviewing people from different late night shows, past and present. So I might be doing a book on Saturday Night Live. I used to go to the show back in the day, and I have a lot of adventure stories from camping out when I was a teenager and being friends with people in the cast. So I might do something like that, but we'll see. But for right now, it's just there's some more Johnny Carson stories that I wasn't able to get in the book that I'm hoping to get in the podcast. So I hope people check that out.
Oh, just fascinating. Can I be your best friend?
Oh, yeah. Let's do this. I'm coming into Chicago. I'm coming to your place. I have to see the Lucy glasses. Maybe you'll let me try them on.
I will absolutely let you do that. And I'll also be giving you one of these behind the curtain coffee mugs for you to enjoy your coffee, which our viewers and listeners can get by going to WGNTV.com/store. And there's also shower curtains and skateboards with that logo. So you never know what you want, Mark.
I'm so there. This was so much fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for spending so much time with me. Very much appreciate it.
This was great.
That's an end of another edition of Paul Listen Behind the Curtain. We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us, everybody.